Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the ongoing evolution of our consciousness and how that, particularly now in these times, seems to be accelerating, activating, coming into a new expression, or maybe it's an old expression. So we're going to be talking about that tonight with my guest, Terry Degler, and especially her point of view coming from the book that she's written called The Divine Feminine Fire. Terry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Alan, for having me here. And I was getting some feedback today on my Facebook page how auspicious people thought it was that we were speaking about the divine feminine on this day in the United States, when we could certainly use some guidance, some inspiration, right?
Yeah, well, no, I think you've written a very important book in terms of telling, talking about this spirit, the activation of the Shakti that's in us all, our creative potential. And I do think Obama represents more of that potential for people than Mitt Romney. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, one interesting thing to think about is how, one question that I've often thought about is how, if you look at all the people in the arts, from, you know, musicians, actors, writers, we all tend to be, you know, a center or left of center, and certainly not 100%, but a really high percentage, and I wonder why that is. I think that would be a topic for a whole other discussion. When we get back to that idea of creativity, one of the ways I like to look at it, and what I do in the book, as you know, in The Divine Feminine Fire, is I go really back to ancient texts, you know, to ancient yoga texts, these age-old verses from the yogis who talk about this relationship that they saw very clearly between what they called Shakti or Kundalini Shakti, but it was this life force, this intensified life force that they said very clearly was evolutionary energy. And this evolutionary energy was transforming us slowly, gently, over the ages. It's been transforming us. And they identified this as Shakti, and they called it feminine. They saw it the feminine side or the feminine face of the divine, and they saw it as an actual force that not only transformed us, but opened up our inspiration, opened up our creativity. So they wouldn't have seen a difference between making art or making a statue so much, to the beautiful ancient statues you see of the, like the tantric poses or whatever. Those, they wouldn't have seen that difference between that and the spiritual transformation of consciousness. So what I try to do in the book is look back at those ancient yogic, passages that talk about that relationship between inspiration and creativity. And then look in other traditions, like the Jewish Kabbalah in terms of Shekinah, and Old Testament Christianity in terms of Sophia, so that we can see how all of our traditions give us this idea, if we look deep enough, that we're all connected, and that we are connected to this divine feminine energy. It's evolutionary. It's moving us forward. And tuning into our creativity, then, is one way to access that creative energy, that transformative energy. Sorry.
Okay. No, I know where you're coming from, and I appreciate the perspective, because it's so important now to activate our creative potential. I think the artist has always been to the left, because the artist is at the forefront of evolution. The artist's role, and I'm writing about this, is to pull in the new energies to create new perceptions, new awarenesses, a new awareness of what reality is. And so it just goes along that the only way that can really happen is new energy flows through our being. Creativity and evolution are, in a way, one and the same. It is the feminine coming through. I mean, that's why we're birthed through the feminine, because it's like the newness of who we are can give the potential of our creativity to the world. It comes through that feminine line. I mean, so I, I understand what you're saying there.
That's really a beautiful way to put it, too. I think one of the things that I try to talk about in the book is if we think of the divine feminine throughout the ages, right? We always think of it as birthing the earth, the mother of creativity, the mother of the universe, and so she's the creatrix of the universe. She's the creative force of the universe. She's also the creative force within us. That doesn't mean our masculine side isn't equally important, this inner masculine, if you want to think of it like that, or divine masculine, if you're comfortable with the divine. But they're equally important. But that birthing, exactly what you're saying, that idea that we're birthing, that we're recreating, is seen as feminine and has been seen like that for ages. So it behooves us to tune into that as we're on this journey.
Terry Degler in her book, The Divine Fire, and we're just going to get her right back on the line. And it's about creativity and your yearning to express yourself. So basically, she goes into all the traditions that honor the feminine and show how it's a part of our creative potential that lies in each one of us that we're here to fully express. She talks about the Shekinah in Kabbalah, Judaism, Sophia in the Christian tradition, Shakti in the Hindu tradition. And I think now is the time that we come forward and have the feminine really, in a sense, that creative force, lead the way in the world. Because for so long we rested on tradition, and I think now is a time where all the traditions are letting go of their hold on our culture and our mind, and we are being activated in totally new ways. That's why I call this program New Realities.
New techno. How's it sounding? Is this better?
It's much better. Yeah, it's great. So,
good.
I sort of like to end on this note, but I just usually ask people at the end of the show, well, if everyone was living at this point of expression, what would it look like? So why don't we just really start there? If everyone allowed the creative fire of this feminine to go through, what would our culture look like? What would each of us be in our expression?
Well, I'm part of a discussion group, and we had that as our topic. It's been a couple years ago, but it was fascinating because we could see how it would change everything. Our political system would be influenced, our schools especially. And it might even be that I know some people who are trying to get more yoga in the schools. And even a simple thing like that might make a profound change in the way we see education. But I think if we could all tune into that, first of all, we would stop. The key to it, to me, in my own personal experience, and I've had what I think for me have been life-shattering, life-changing mystical experiences. Now, I don't think I'm any big mystic or anything. I don't think, you know, I think my experiences are like a little dot on the backside of a great mystic, right? But for me, they were life-changing. And every time, the thing that I saw was that reality, the way we see it today, faded. And that the separation between myself and the tree I was looking at, or the grass I was looking at, or the dog I was looking at, or the friend I was with, those boundaries vanished. They just melted away.
Well, what were those? Can you go into the specifics of those mystical experiences? So
One, and this is just I guess the most, and I've written about this in both The Fiery Muse, my book that Random House Canada published before this one, and in The Divine Feminine Fire, which is my latest book. But I tell the story a little bit. But I was about 13 or 14, and I'd had this big spiritual crisis. I didn't believe in God. I was totally an atheist. I was totally detached from anything spiritual. I thought the Bible was a bunch of bunk, and I'd thrown it all out. And I was a member of a group well, it was Job's daughters, which in Canada nobody knows what that is, but it's daughters of Masons, right? And I wanted to stay in this group, but I couldn't ethically stay in it because I was now an atheist. So I went to the adult who was called the guardian or whatever in those days, and I told her my dilemma and I quit. And she wrote me this letter later, and she explained that the problem wasn't religion, it was that I didn't understand that God was love. And she just wrote those words, God is love. And I opened this letter, and I read those words, and this is a concept. I was raised in the Episcopal Church, and I had been active in the church as a preteen, but this concept had never occurred to me. And of course, now we hear that concept all the time. But this was like, you know, few decades back, right? And I read those words, God is love, and they just sort of dissolved into the page. And something happened in my brain. It was like this, oh my God, that is true. That is real. God is love. And I didn't even begin to understand what it meant, but I ran out. I raised in Idaho and, in the West, and I ran outside a storm was coming across the desert, and I ran out and I jumped on my horse without bridle or saddle. And I started galloping the horse around the pastures and along this riverbank that ran behind our house. And as the storm came, I totally dissolved into this storm and into the horse. And I just kept riding and riding the horse, and everything dissolved. There was no I understood that God was love. But on some other level, I understood now that everything was one. Those words wouldn't even have been able to come into my head at that age. But I understood it at some cellular level, and I saw it. Everything was suffused with light, and I was just absolutely one with this wild horse I was riding. I mean, the horse was going crazy in the storm, and I was just holding on to her mane, and I was galloping around.
Wow, that is so dramatic and romantic and beautiful of an image. It's just like a movie, you know. It's great.
It's funny. I've thought about it so many times. I don't even think of how, but you're right. And it was great because anybody who's seen my book or my pictures, I'm a redhead, right? And my horse was this red sorrel horse, so it would have looked really good, I'm sure.
I'd like to do a movie about that.
But spiritual awakening
there, you and the horse and the storm and dissolving. Yes, it is great. No, thank you for sharing that, because I think, it sounds like that sparked the rest of your life, in a sense.
It totally determined my life, and I went through, I was a kid from a, broken home and a, alcoholic father, and, I had a tough time. It took me years to kind of let that side of me, not the wild, crazy cowgirl side, which warred with this spiritual side for many years. And it still wars a bit, I have to say. But it was that dissolving into the oneness, and that every other mystical experience I've had since then is that same thing, is where those boundaries dissolve. And that, so this really is getting back to what your question was, what would things look like? Because all the mystics tell us, even though this was life-shattering to me, it wasn't anything like an experience Saint Teresa had,
I would say it's
qualitatively the same, if not quantitatively.
No,
if you
I'm
know
sure
what I mean.
It's exactly the same, and in your own way. But so you're saying, getting back to that question, if yes.
So they all these mystics, regardless of the religion, and that's, I do in the book, is I talk about mystics, different traditions. That as soon as they tell us that everything is one. They keep saying that we're one with the divine, that we're one with each, that everything is one. So as soon as you have that idea that everything is one, everything alters. How could you go out and rape Mother Earth when you understand you're one with the Earth? How could you go out and shoot somebody just because they're a Muslim and you're a Christian, or or a Muslim shoots a Christian, when you understand suddenly that we're all one? That we're as a united, it's like I'm your little finger, you're my
you're the top of my head. We're all one. We don't go around smashing ourselves.
I just want to know,
right?
And I've heard lots of people describe their mystical experiences. I mean, that's sort of why I do this show. I'm very interested in what it is that initiates people into this other level of reality. But why do that oneness, that awareness of oneness, why did it stop? Or can you live in that state? I mean, I'm sure these saints that you write about actually did, Mahadevi actually lived in that state of oneness. But how come you came out of it, or and other people too? I mean, I've had those experiences too. Why can't we live there?
I think it's harder to do it today in our world, but I mean, I don't want that to be an excuse. But if you look at what the yogis said, these ancient yogis, when they said that this process has a very physiological, biological basis, that it's rooted in the body, and this energy that they called Kundalini, which is it's an intensification of this divine feminine. Kundalini, there's a lot of stuff about it today, but they make it sound like it's some weird, different energy, but it's just the spiritual transformative energy. It's a concentration. And what they would say was this energy, when it's flowing properly from the base of the spine to the brain, it can work its transformative process, that it really needs to work in the body. And one of my messages is that this divine feminine is rooted in the body. It's physiological. That doesn't make it any less spiritual. And I love it when these scientists come out and say, oh, well, you know, some brain, you know, that was just some hormone switched in the brain or something, so it's not spiritual. Well, God has to work somehow, right? It's just the way the divine is working through the body. But so what these yogis would tell us is that when this energy is flowing more readily and more smoothly, more purely through the body, it can work its transformation on the brain.
Brain. With you, you had some sort of a Kundalini experience in that awakening, but why, I mean, yes, and it flows, so you're saying, how does it keep flowing? You say your teacher was Gopi Krishna, who had this amazing Kundalini awakening that really did stay with him his whole life, I would assume, from what I've heard. But how can we have this stay with us? I mean, of course, well, there's exercises you can do.
It's taught in it. We're taught in the Eightfold Path of Buddhism, and the Eightfold Path of Patanjali. And in the Christian tradition, in the Ten Commandments, first of all, there's a process, right? We have to transform spiritually. You know what the yamas and the niyamas and yogas, the observances and the restraints, right? We become just better people, right? We stop being so angry and greedy and selfish, and we try to work on those things. And which is just exactly what the Ten Commandments tell us, right? So we work on that spiritually. But there's also a physiological aspect of it, which is why Hatha Yoga was developed. A lot of people, I mean, there's millions of teachers, yoga teachers in the United States today that don't know that the physical postures, Hatha Yoga, which is where the physical postures come, this was a system developed to awaken Kundalini. And what they were saying was, you need to get your body ready too. The body was becoming strong and straight. The spine was to be very straight. So we need to have our bodies healthy so that it could hold this energy. This is what Hatha Yoga was all about. So there's the physical side of it. There's the spiritual side of it. There's the meditation side of it, which is, you know, if we look at the Eightfold Path, first there's the yamas and the niyamas. And then we have restraints and, you know, our observances and then our restraints. And then we have asana, which when Patanjali wrote it, it just meant sitting. But it was sitting posture where you were sitting very straight, like probably what we would think of something like the lotus position. But so the other postures were developed.
But, you know, I do think, I mean, you said you didn't think it was, I think it's easier these days. I think what's happening to the planet and to the vibration of the earth is that it's accelerating. I think the earth itself is having a kundalini awakening, and it's activating our earth body. So I'm meeting a lot more people who are having this awakening, actually not necessarily by yoga.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. That is by any spiritual practice, or just randomly, or doing their art,
right,
or whatever. I think you're absolutely right.
So
it is happening all over the place.
It's very exciting. I think it's very exciting that so many people are waking up to these energies. Yeah, I mean, it can freak people out if they have no spiritual orientation, like what's going on. And that movie Wake Up I saw recently is about this guy. Suddenly, he had all this energy and this healing energy, and he started to see auras and ghosts and levels of consciousness, and he had no idea what was happening. And he had this kundalini awakening. And so that's why I think your book is important now, because it gives a sort of map for people
like you calling it a map. I kind of call it a framework, but I like the idea of a map. That's right. But I just meant that it's hard, even though the awakenings are happening. What I meant was harder. It would be harder to live in what's called in yoga Jivan Mukti, which it meant to live in that state of consciousness, because the world, it's hard because you have to still go out and make a living. You know, you can't walk around with your little bowl and have people put rice in it anymore, right? You know, so that's what I meant. But I think you're right about the awakening is definitely happening.
But, you know, I think, the patriarchy or the platform we've come and emerged out of this materialistic world has been based on making money. And I think, you know, also what you sort of lay out, it's really our value is on our creativity, how much we can activate that divine fire. And I think we can start to build a new culture that honors creativity, inspiration, the arts, the sense of feeling, and I think that's the transition we are in now, because we didn't incarnate to make money. I mean, it's not a bad thing, but we incarnated to feel the divine fire moving through us, I would say.
Yes, and I keep talking about yoga because not that it's not in the other religions, but it's so clearly laid out there. But what they would have said was that this is the energy of evolution. It is really evolutionary energy, this fire that's working. It is transformative energy. So when we tune into it, in one way we allow it then to transform us, and then it's a cyclical effect. The transformation that's going on allows us to even transform further. So we transform, we bring our creativity out, and even more important, well, not more important, but on the same way, is that we think of creativity as new ideas. I mean, we need new ideas. We need new solutions to world problems. That's this creative energy that will come. So we bring that out, we create a better world, and that allows us then, or just we create a better life for ourselves in some way, that allows more of the energy to transform us more. It's this wonderful, powerful, cyclical effect that, to me, exactly what excites you so much, it excites me that we see this, because it's creative solutions to the world's problems that are coming too.
But it's a way of thinking too. I mean, I try to, you know, put a couple of hours into writing every day and activating my creative ideas. But if I had to, like, get up and do a 9-to-5 job, like a lot of people, I would feel disconnected from that. And so, I mean, I think there's something in the whole society that has to change that needs to honor this creative potential, and in a way it does honor it. I mean, the great songwriters and painters and artists do get acknowledgement, but each one of us has that, like you said, that amazing creative potential. We're born for that reason.
I know, I keep, it, in a
yeah,
way
tell
it's
me.
Ironic at this time when although I am a U.S. citizen and I voted today electronically, yay, but I've lived in Canada a long time and we're just having this horrible thing happen where money to the arts is being cut right, left and center because we have a really conservative prime minister for the first time ever. That we have anybody this conservative, and he's just slashed money to the arts, slashed it. Mm-hmm. And ironically, at this time when we need this nurturing of the creative energy, so let us hope that that doesn't happen in the U.S. and well, hope that it's or doesn't happen worse than it already has.
Yeah, I mean, of course it's already happening, but I mean, I don't think we can overestimate the value of art. I mean, why did we incarnate in the first place? I mean, if people don't see the value of art, we have to ask, well, why are they here? You know? What are they here to do with their lives, in a sense? If it's not to express and to feel and to love and be, you know, honored. You know, I just read a great quote by John F. Kennedy who really honored the arts, and he said, "I'm certain that after the dust of the centuries have passed over our cities, we too will be remembered not for our victories or defeats in war and politics, but for our contribution to the human spirit." So I think when we talk about the arts, we sort of put it into a box, and the arts are really the human spirit itself. It's an acknowledgement. It's a activation of the spirit. It's a feeling of the spirit is what I get.
And isn't it interesting that we use the word the creative spirit? I was moved by the creative spirit. I mean, people will say that who have no spiritual leanings at all, but they were moved by the creative spirit. And that's exactly, I think, what you're talking about, that this creative spirit, and this creative spirit is the exact same thing as the Holy Spirit, if we want to put it in Christian terms. If you go to the Bible and look at every time the word Holy Spirit is used, or you look at the word or Ruach HaKodesh in Hebrew, if you look at which it means holy, would be more better translated as holy wind. When holy wind or Holy Spirit is working, there's transformation, there's action. Something
look
happens.
At the word
something
inspire,
gets transformed.
Right?
Inspired. Somebody is inspired. Whether it's Ezekiel when seeing the wheel, or it's Paul on the road to Damascus, they transform. That is the role of this divine creative spirit, whatever we want to call it. And you are so right. This is what's going to create the new reality. This is it.
It has to be, but we need to not just put money aside for the arts. We need to see that that's our whole purpose of incarnating, to express ourselves. Self-expression is why we came here.
I love that, self-expression. We are expressing ourselves, our true selves, which is this divine, holy energy we all hold within. And that's exactly it, self-expression. And it's in realizing what the true self is. That's part of it.
Right. And you know, in like the 19th century, when Joyce was writing in the early 20th century, they called the soul the feminine part of themselves, the soul, the creative soul in the artist was the feminine in these.
Right, and to bring it back to, my mind's just gone black, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin was, you know, Catholic priest, a Jesuit priest, a monk, and he called it the eternal feminine, which is a great line, the eternal feminine that was the creative force. And he also believed, if you read his writings really clearly, that this eternal feminine was an expression of the Holy Spirit. And that's why, of course, the church, what they sent him to Mongolia. They really did. That's where he lived. They sent him to Mongolia, right, for these ideas. But they're so perfect for our time and what we're going through.
Well, I think your book is about helping people make the transition from a materialistic society to one that honors creativity and the arts and self-expression. You know, I can't see a better future than one that values that part of ourselves to be all that we can be, really, you know.
And maybe one of the keys, and I try to talk about this a little bit in the Divine Feminine Fire, you know, is the idea that the arts are part of it, but inspiration goes farther. And then maybe this is one way we get to the people who who've lost that connection with their true self, with their creative spirit. Is that we work at it and say, so you work in a business and you have to sell widgets. Okay, so you need to come up with 5 ways to sell widgets. Well, that's creativity, that's creative thinking. And if we carry that further, we look at somebody like Al Gore, who comes up with, or in Canada, our big hero, David Suzuki, who's always coming up with new creative ideas and ways to save the environment. New ideas, new ways. That's the creative spirit. So maybe some of these people who don't identify with the arts, we can get to them by putting creativity first in a broader sense to see how it works practically in their lives. And then once they've tasted it, once that divine feminine energy has begun to work in them, opening up to it more and more as we create this new society, this new reality. This isn't going to happen overnight, right? But we have to open up to it.
Well, I think that also goes back to the question, like, most society wants to put people into a box, keep them, very locked down so things don't evolve because it threatens the structures to evolve.
The status quo, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why artists have always been to the left of center, because they threaten the status quo, because they're all about change. That's why Plato banned the artist from his republic, you know, his utopian society, because it meant that the artists were part of a dynamic transformation, which essentially is who we are. I mean, that's why things like, I think, the whole communist, you know, block of countries collapsed, because they suppressed that creative, natural human side of who we are.
I think another way, you know, one of the things I try to do in the Divine Feminine Fire is look at how creative spirit is all part of the same thing. And one of the ways we tune into that is our yearning. If we can tune into what we really, on the deepest level, yearn for. Like, we think we're yearning for a new car, but really we're yearning for something to fill up some kind of hole that's inside of us. We get in touch with that. That is really our desire to know our true nature. And we have this, once we tune into that and then we realize that our desire to ease suffering that we see around us, our desire to save Mother Earth, and all of that is, and to express ourselves creatively, that it's all one cosmic impetus. There's no difference between our desire to end suffering and our desire to express ourselves creatively. They're all triggered by Shakti. It's called Shakti Yoga, or Sophia, or Shekinah is triggering that. So when we understand that impetus, that power is all the same energy, it opens it all up. And I, like on this weekend, I wish everybody in New York could come up here, because I'm teaching a workshop again this weekend on just this topic. We're starting Friday night and all day Saturday, and we're working on exactly that, just opening up to that divine feminine energy, opening that creative energy, and understanding how that can trigger transformation in ourselves, and then transformation in society, and then that, again, transforms us. So,
well, it reminds me of what Eckhart Tolle says. He says, you are not living life. Life is living you.
So, what a beautiful way to put it. That the life energy, that's another thing we learned from those old texts, is that this life energy is intelligent. Like if you take a yoga class and you do pranayama, right? Your pranayama, prana is breath and yama is the practice of breath. So you're breathing, but prana also means life energy, right? So, but very few people talk about the idea, the essential idea, life energy is intelligent in those
yeah.
systems. It's told us that this is intelligent life energy. And you see that in Jewish mysticism. You see it in Old Testament Christianity if you dig far enough to find it.
We see it in biology, actually. I mean, especially
yeah, I can't believe how anybody could think that there's not some intelligence that's running this life energy.
It's actually pure intelligence, I think. You know,
that's a beautiful way to put it. Pure intelligence. Yes.
Which is not a mental thing. It's what creativity is. Creativity is the purity of life, seeking new forms, seeking new ways of expression, like, which is why, I mean, I had a teacher that said, we're here to make known the unknown, which is really the reason we've came to create new forms in the world, whether that's science or art or widgets or whatever it is, you know, it's, we came to create more. We're not here to complete our karma or to, you know, heal. I mean, all those things can happen, but really we're here to make known the unknown.
It's a beautiful way to put it. And if you think about that, sometimes when I've had these experiences of when everything dissolves, right? The boundaries are dissolved, that what you really see is pulsing life energy. This pure, as you say, pure intelligence, this pure intelligent life energy is pulsing through everything, and it is everything. It is the because the ancient yogis see that really clearly, that everything is made of prana or shakti. Prana shakti is what they call it, this divine, everything is made of it. So one of these experiences I had, which was briefer than the other one, but it was, I was out one day in a little park walking my dog, and everything just started to dissolve. I saw this light everywhere, and I had this image that the divine feminine was dipping into these buckets, and she had these buckets of different colored prana. It was all life energy, but it was just different colored, and she was just painting the universe with it. Like, so even though it just looked like, it looked like green leaves and a brown tree trunk, it was really just prana expressing itself. Then you could see it, this divine, intelligent life energy. And I think you're so right when you say we're born to express that. I love that image of
thank you.
We're expressing it.
So that experience starts, I mean, you have these moments of oneness, but then it starts to fade. I'm just interested. I mean, it comes on maybe for no reason at all, but then it does something remain, or does it just fade away completely, or what?
Well, I think it remains in the transformation, and you know, certainly like any body practicing some spiritual practice or on some path, you know, you'd like it to stay there forever. But I think it is the key is that it's one way we can think of it is if we think of the brain, right? The brain is the organ of perception. And we think of these mystics, if we think of the idea that it wasn't that they saw some new reality. It was that something in their mind or their brain was transformed so that they could see the way reality really is. It wasn't that they saw something different. It was that they saw what you would call new reality. They could see this
right,
oneness.
which is the veils have been taken
the
away.
The veils, I mean, were torn.
Yes,
but
yes.
What this, the basis of it having a biological basis is that the brain, something in the brain, which is called in yoga the Brahmaranda, is actually transformed and activated so that this can, you can be seen. So what happens with this, the way this explanation is, of if you look at it from these yoga texts, is that this energy flows up, it begins to transform the brain because of whatever, you know, blockages we have, or that we don't live a good lifestyle or whatever, it goes back down. but it is constantly transforming. I think that's what's happening to me. I mean, I can feel it flow up, I feel it flow down, and
I try to recenter
myself and try to
about Gopi Krishna. I mean, you met him, right? You hung out with Gopi Krishna. I mean, that's quite a gift, because he was quite an amazing person. But talk about his awakening, because when something happened to him, and it wasn't always pleasant, it really... it stayed with him. He had this divine consciousness for the rest of his life.
Well, yeah, it took a while, though. Yeah, he had this big experience.
Talk about his process, though.
And then it went up and down, and he discovered eventually, you know, ways to help his diet and so on to help the energy start to flow. He had what in yoga terms would be called a misdirected energy. It kind of went up right, and then it went up kind of on the wrong side of his spine. It went up the pingala, but that's all very technical. But if that's right, if what these yogas are telling us, that this is a gradual process, right? And one of the great things Gopi Krishna said,
it's an awakening, boom, it's happened, boom, it turns on.
But one of the things he always said was the best awakening is the gradual one. Yes,
right.
He had this big boom, and somebody like me, I come along and I have little booms or bangs or whatever. That doesn't put me any further ahead on the spiritual path. It's my working on my spiritual self, you know, trying to be a
less
angry
person. Well, also the personal self. I mean, I think people have separated their emotional bodies from their spiritual body, and you can't ignore the personal work, your own, you know, psychological baggage. I mean, I think that's been the problem with the spirituality, is that people have ignored their
religion, you know, organized religion, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to spirituality. Would that be accurate to say?
No, I would say also people have kind of meditated themselves into something, but they haven't worked on their relationships with their mother and father and you know.
Exactly.
And I think that's also needs to happen. But I'm also curious, what was Gopi Krishna like? What kind of person was he?
He was, I mean, when I met him, he was, you know, he was in his 70s, and he was in a pretty solid state of being in an enlightened state. So he was just, he's like a lot other people say about their spiritual teachers. You just went into the room, and he just radiated this you know, beautiful energy. But to me, what I always thought was so interesting was that, and this, I had friends that went to India and, you know, helped him do his publishing and work over there and he did a tremendous amount of social justice work too, especially for women, which I think is very, even in 1948, he was working on big social justice issues for women in India, which I always thought was interesting, right? But a bit of a side, but he was always very thoughtful. Like, he was always very careful not to make bad karma. Like, he always did to the absolute best of his ability the right thing, the compassionate thing, the kind thing, the thing that was the most right. And I, as a person, you know, taking away, you know, what stage of enlightenment he was at or whatever, that as a human being, he was always doing the compassionate right thing. And in the smallest way, I never saw him do something that was harmful. He always tried to do the least harm, the most compassionate path. And he always said, you know, the way to enlighten, people say, oh, I want to get enlightened and I want to awaken my kundalini or whatever. And he would say, live a balanced life, you know, follow the tenets of your faith, whether it's the Ten Commandments or Christ's two great commandments, love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your spirit. Oh, and love your neighbor like yourself. That's our tough one, right? Follow those commandments and then just live a balanced life. But always, always do karma yoga. Like, so always be involved in some kind of charitable work. So that if you spend, no matter what you did in your life, spend an hour a day in charitable work, in doing good for humankind. So the equivalent of at least 7 hours a week, And,
right.
and he said that was the way to transform, to allow this energy to gradually transform us into these yogis of the future that he really believed, like many other great thinkers have, like Sri Aurobindo and others, that this transformation of consciousness would allow us to be human beings who were at a higher stage of evolution, where we lived in peace. We could really bring this creative energy into daily life. And that would be the way humanity would be. And this would be, you know, down the road. Obviously, we're not there yet.
Well, we're closer. I do think we are closer than we've ever been. And I'm not saying we're there, but I think the awareness that we are a collective consciousness, that we are all connected through the field. I just think a lot of the old assumptions, even the old science and even the old religions are dropping away.
It's,
I mean,
crumbling.
It sounds
right.
Sort of what the Chinese say, Tao Te Ching, the way of virtue. What you're talking about is virtue, the virtuous life. The virtuous person is one who is there for others and their own evolution. So, I mean, yes, all the great wisdom traditions have talked about these ways, and I think something is happening. I mean, it seems like there is this awareness. I mean, maybe just because I'm in it, but don't you think there's an awareness that seems to be going on, that there is this bigger mind, this bigger connection with all of us?
Yes, absolutely, and that's what I'm trying to say in the Divine Feminine Fire, is that we're at this stage of evolution. And so this isn't me talking, right? I mean, lots and lots of people are seeing this, that we're at this transformative stage, and at this very transformative stage, this, and it is, we're ready as a human race. We're biologically, psychologically more ready than we've ever been to awaken this energy. We're ready for it. We need it, but we're ready for it. And we see it happening all over. And I think what you said earlier was really important, that we need a guide map, whether it's the guide map that I set out in Divine Feminine Fire that relates it to Christianity, Judaism, and this yoga path from Hinduism. So whether it's that structure that we have, that but we need the various kinds of people like Barbara Marks Hubbard, people who are talking about transformation of consciousness and giving people a framework so that when they have these experiences, they understand that it is part of it. They're not afraid anymore. I was Spiritual Emergence Network, which started in the 1990s in California, and I was at a talk once where we founded the Kundalini Research Network, which is still alive and going. And somebody got up and talked about, one of the psychologists, a clinical psychologist, caught up and talked about a woman who called her from Texas. And she said, this woman called her from Texas and had a real strong Southern accent. And she says, you know, I think God is sitting on my head. And she said, I went to my minister and he told me it was the devil, and I went to my doctor and he told me I was crazy, and my husband thinks I need medication, and he says, I just don't know what to do. And so this counselor said, well, you know, maybe God is sitting on your head. She said, do you think so? And she says, yeah. She says, I think it's okay. And she says, that's good. That's all I needed to know. And she just went off with her life, and she was very happy with the idea that God was sitting on her head. And if you look at all the ancient pictures, whether they're Christian or whatever tradition, Muslim, they have the halos, right, that are painted in, because there is this feeling in these experiences that this divine energy is coming out of the top of your head, which in Hinduism would have been called Shiva consciousness, right, or in Buddhism, the thousand petal lotus, the halos in Christianity, because there is actually this very physical feeling that this something is divine
is
coming out of your
feeling.
Head.
I mean, you talk about the goddess hidden in the body, or the divine, that force is hidden in the body, because it has to I mean, I think awakening, enlightenment, you know, it's not just a mental thing. It's a physical thing. It's part of our bodies.
And this, yes, exactly, and it is, and it's been talked about in so many images from so many cultures of this idea that it rises up the spine and into the brain, the mind, and that's the process we need to facilitate, regardless of what our religious or cultural background is. We need to find a framework where we can be comfortable with that great power, because it is great power. The experiences I talk about in my life are, like I say, maybe be minor on the cosmic scale, but they were huge experiences of a divine power, of force
but
moving through me.
I don't think there is any minor or major. I think
okay,
what
it's
you,
a good. Okay, I just don't want anybody
to
think
major,
like I'm some great spiritual leader or master or something, right?
No,
that's
no,
all
no.
I want to be careful about,
you're
right?
Waking a lot of people up to what happens to them.
That's right. And we need to be able to feel comfortable with holding that in our biological physical bodies. And one of the things you kept a few times, you've referred to emotions, and I think that's really important, because this triggers our emotional side of our nature, right? We need to be comfortable with holding emotion in our body.
Right. But I don't mean the old emotions of drama. I mean, yeah, it's important to have those, but I mean the sense of being able to feel, and they might be feelings we have no words for. I think that's the gift of the arts, of like music. Music doesn't make you just feel one thing. It kind of activates a sense of feeling that has no words. And I think that the value of the arts, of art itself, is that it gives us an extension of our abilities to feel. And that's why we're here, is to feel. The divine Shakti is happening because we need to wake up and express ourselves and start to be in touch with our yearnings. I mean, they should, like you say in your book, I mean, they should teach in elementary schools kids talk about what they're yearning to do. What do you yearn for?
Wouldn't that be beautiful? Wouldn't that be beautiful if we could actually bring this into the school system, where people actually were taught what was really important, right?
Well, what else is important? You see, the reason they want you to be a lawyer and accountant and all those things, because it perpetuates the corporate state, and the corporate state is what's at odds with the creative inspiration of the individual. I mean, there's no room for that within a society run by, except for people at the top that are always using their creativity to make more profit, which is fine. I mean, that's their creative potential, but it leaves everyone else out. So I think those things are like dinosaurs that, you know, they've gotten too big to feel who they are. And so I think that's why your book and others are really important. And especially as you highlight some of the people who were individual enough to wake up to their own creative potential. You talk about Mahadevi. Do you have any of the poetry that she wrote as she was, you know, inspired by that? I think it's in your book. I don't know. I think poetry actually just activates.
Well,
those.
What's interesting is that, you know, in the Yoga Sutras, they talk about the ancient yogic texts talk about how they describe that. They say that the yogi who actually reaches enlightenment will have poetry dripping like ambrosia off his tongue, that he or she will, and that was a sign of enlightenment. I think our yearning is, that's one of the things Mahadevi talks about so beautifully. In one of her poems, she says, "I've bathed in turmeric, put on cloth of gold, tied a silken gown around, and cried, 'Come, Lord, come, O husband, come. Your coming is a birth to me.' And crying still, I scan the roads to see if you, Oh, my Lord, white as jasmine will come. My mouth is parched. And I think that's what we feel today. We're standing as we're like her. We've dressed like a bride. We're waiting for the divine to come to us. And our mouth is parched until we allow this divine feminine energy to flow with us and create this union. And this is what Mahadevi's talking about, is a union between the divine masculine inside and the divine feminine inside. Mm-hmm. That the feminine rises up and meets Shiva consciousness at the top of the
right, just it can't be all just the Shakti. The Shakti has to meet the Shiva in order
that's
to create.
That's right. You have to have this.
Yeah. No, I'm just looking at your book and Kavita. I'm going to read a poem of hers. I found.
Good.
But who is she? I mean,
Kavita Bird is a woman who she lives in India now, but she's originally from the States, and she's been a brilliant poet. And read that piece from her. Because one of the things to make clear is the Divine Feminine Fire talks about these ancient mystics and these yoga and Christian texts and so on. But it's also the story of five amazing contemporary women and how they've allowed this creative spirit to flow through them and transform themselves and the world around them. So, Kavita's a really good choice.
Have you met these women? Are they still alive?
I interviewed everybody, and interestingly enough, Kavita, because she was living in India, I'd never met her till I came to New York the weekend I met you. I actually came to New York to meet Kavita because she was in New York
on her way to Brazil.
She's not. She's in Brazil now.
I'd love to meet her because I'll read this poem from the Love Songs of the Undivided. And it says, my heart makes love in secret silence to all that is. My womb gives birth to the universe, and my breasts suckle the stars. Who knows, near or far, in this cave of silence, whose earth is the sky, no one sits but all existence. I am this which never dies, which rocks the seas of being in its dreams, and cradles all creation in the infinite unseen.
Isn't that amazing?
That's like a Rumi. That's like a classic, poetry of creation itself. What was she like when you met her, Kavita?
Very dedicated to bringing peace to the world, working in many ways right now with... the organizations that she's working with in New York, my mind has gone blank, but it'll come in a second. But totally dedicated to social justice, her life, and this allowing this creative spirit in whatever ways it's come to her. Sometimes in poetry, it's come in music, it's come in just propelling her to work in social justice. She's one of those beautiful, beautiful people who actually walk the talk. She lives the life that she says that she knows you should live. And she's just spreading that light wherever she goes.
Well, there's this other woman you mentioned who read the works of Paul Brunton, and talks about reading, The Search for Secret India, which is really an amazing book. I mean, it actually, Paul Brunton was the first Westerner to really sit with Ramana Maharshi, and he said about Ramana in that book, a river of silence flowed from him. But the woman that who was inspired by him, what's her name again?
Britta. Her name was Britta, and she's passed away now. She died at the age of, 93, and I met her when she was about 90. And she'd read my prior book, the Fiery Muse, which was called Fiery Muse Creativity and the Spiritual Quest, which is still available, too. But she'd read that book, and she started to realize that this quest for Jesus that she'd been on all of her life and this experience of the Holy Spirit that she had had was in fact a Kundalini experience, that they were one and the same. And it was like this woman at 90 years of age was opening up and writing to me just reams and reams of letters that I still have about how this, at 90, she was having this whole new awakening, right?
Wow.
And she was amazing, and she had these beautiful paintings that she'd done, and yeah, and her story is in the book too, how her experience of the Holy Spirit and how it totally transformed her art. Like she said that her art was very mechanical. It was good, but there was no life to it. That's how she said it wasn't alive. And then she had this experience of the Holy Spirit, and suddenly her art became alive. She says, I drew like Picasso. And some of her paintings were, I mean, they were just gorgeous paintings that she made after this experience.
Oh.
And so she was cool to me because she was somebody here, a Dutch woman at the age of 90, who began to see not just the creativity, but suddenly to see the union of the different spiritual traditions in her own experience.
And then you have this woman, Anya, who's really interesting. I mean, in the book you talk about her.
She's somebody I still know. She's lives in Canada, but she's also very shy about who she is. So Anya's actually the only person in the book who has a pseudonym. She was amazing. She works in the medical field, but she also had these profound spiritual experiences. She had no idea what they were, but she gained enough, she joined some spiritual groups or whatever that gave her enough feeling that what it was, she wasn't crazy and it was okay. And then she went out and did all this fantastic environmental work and came up with all these creative ideas for bringing environmental ideas. And this was in the early 90s when there was an upsurge of environmental energy. She created these cafes where she had singers and songwriters come and artists and performers and uniting everything with environmental work. So to me, she's a great example too, because she was a housewife and a medical worker, married to someone in the medical field, and just started transforming her very local. When we talk about think globally and act locally, that's just what she did. She brought it to her small community and created this huge environmental awareness in her community with this work that she did.
Right, but you know what? I mean, yes, thank you for that. But what seems like when all these examples you're citing, even the old ones, Hildegard and Mahadevi, all these women and men too, I guess, who've had this experience, they give, there's no longer the personal that they're after. They like even someone like Amachi, the hugging guru, she doesn't have like a personal preference. They give their lives over to something bigger than themselves. And I think that's the secret in a way, it feels like.
Yeah, it's like because when you see the oneness, you realize we're all one. You can't look at the starving child in Africa and not care, because that starving child in Africa is your child. So one thing, and what Gopi Krishna was saying was, if you don't feel that, I mean, if you're not already, you're not already some great guru who sees it all the time, then practice seeing it. You know, go out and do work, do social justice work, where you see that, and then that becomes your reality. And then that transformation occurs in this cyclical process. Mm-hmm. I mean, in yoga it's called karma yoga, and the idea is that you're part of it is you're cleaning up your karma. But that's not really it. It's that as you practice seeing the oneness in everything, you become one with everything. And becoming one with everything is that state of enlightenment.
Well, I like what you write on the last page. As vessels occupied in this holy act of self-expression, we are bringing the active power of divine love into the universe. We are vessels being filled, as Mahadevi says, with the precious juice of grace. So that we can empty ourselves and pour this soothing grace over Mother Earth and all the beings who inhabit her. That's beautiful. The precious juice of grace.
That's from Mahadevi. I'm filled with the precious juice of grace. And she described herself very much as a vessel. And her poetry, she believed, was pouring this precious juice of grace back onto the world through her poetry.
And it's what we all are. Her power is our power. All we have to do is recognize her for who she is, learn to hold her within our bodies, even when she's at her most active, be patient and courageous, listen to her so she can guide us through the process of evolution and transformation that leads ultimately to oneness. That's how you end
it. That's it. It's really a pretty simple, it's really three steps. Recognize her, know what she is in your life, and hold her, and then pour her back out.
But recognize her as us, you know, my will is thy will. You know, it's like, it's not separate who.
That's exactly it. We hold this power within us because it is us. We are divine, and we are expressions of the divine.
Right. So someone said to me recently or to a group, it's like we are not becoming our higher selves. Our higher selves are becoming us. You know,
that's another way to put it too. It's just, key is this thought of transformation. And a lot of people are talking about transformation of consciousness. A lot of people are talking about divine feminine. One of the things that we need to recognize is that the trigger for the transformation of consciousness is the divine feminine. This is Shakti. That's what these yogis have said. She is the evolutionary energy. It doesn't matter. The masculine face of the divine is absolutely equally as important. But this trigger is Shakti.
What's the masculine face look like? What does that look like?
Well, we have to, you can do it on, if you look on it and just, like just taking creativity, right? If we look at creativity, we can say we tune into the feminine. It's obviously, that's our intuitive side. That's our, you know, it's obviously that's our more intuitive side. You know, it's a stereotype, but stereotypes are created because they have some truth to them, right? So that's our feminine side. But I see myself when I write, like, it pours out of me for this, when I can connect with that deeply feminine creative energy, that mother of the universe, and it pours out of me. And then my other side, if I want to call it my masculine side, it's like my editor can look at that and go,
wow.
Oh, let's move that there. Or I make a painting and that pours out of me, and then my editor says, oh, that blue is too blue. It needs a little red in it. It needs to be a little more purpley. You know, that those two sides of it. So we think of that
both.
Without even thinking about God, right?
Right, right. We need both, but this is that the feminine has been shut down for so long that we need to let that flow to create the balance in us, the balance in the culture, you know. If we cut the arts program, we're cutting the feminine.
That's right. We're just allowing that side of ourselves. And I hate to say masculine, but it really is that intellectual ratio. Not that we have all both of these sides within us, right? This isn't men.
No, but it has
this
to,
is
the other
masculine
side has to
side.
Flow. The intellectual has been overbearing, and we need to come into a balance. It's really
exactly.
Balance.
We need, and that's why I write. But I do want to say that although the Divine Feminine Fire really focuses on women mystics and on women's experiences, my prior book, The Fiery Muse, which is available, talks about mystics about men and women. Like I talk about Brahms and Whitman and Rumi. I do a lot on Rumi in that book. And
Whitman is so amazing. He was such a spiritual person.
Leaves
of Brass,
he was
Song
clearly
of Myself,
on
you know,
the road.
That
yeah.
is just, I mean.
He saw prana. Yeah. He saw the divine intelligent energy. He saw it and he expressed it in his poetry. He saw it pulsing everywhere and in the rhythms of his poetry. He saw it. Mm. And, yeah. So I talk about Whitman and what I do in that book, which is kind of as I take highly creative people who had a mystical nature, like Brahms and Whitman and so on, and then I take mystics who are highly creative, like Hildegard of Bingen, and then ordinary everyday people, men and women, who've had these spiritual experiences, and I try to what's that point of meeting between the mystic who was creative and the creative person who was mystical? What's that point of meeting? What is that? And of course, what I'm saying is that point of meeting is Shakti, right? It's this energy moving through us, right?
Well, so,
but
so
I do men in the other book too.
Right. No, I appreciate that because I think you know it's that that creativity is for all human beings, for everyone. You know, we all are the same as we access that divine. I mean, it comes through each of us differently. But what do you have coming up? What are you working on?
I'm writing a novel.
So you are?
Yes.
About these sort of.
I just, you know, this is my life work to talk about this. So, but it's set in the 1800s, late 1800s, early 1900s. It's set in Boston. And it's about a woman who, it's based on, I'm sure you are familiar with William James and his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience,
where
he really brought mystical experience to the scientific community, to the psychological community.
Although they then ignored him for 100 years, but yes.
Well, yeah, but he was a Harvard professor. But anyway, in the book, he has case histories of people who've had these mystical experiences. So in my novel, what I've done is taken imagined one of these case histories. So the woman meets, she's in a very conflicted situation because she's in a, engaged to someone who's a fundamentalist Christian, and she's having these, because she was raised in India as a child, and she, with a British military family, and she has these experiences of the divine that are very yogic, but she's in this fundamentalist Christian household. And so she, in this book, she meets William James, and she goes along her spiritual journey, and we will find out where it takes her.
That's great. Because
I don't know yet. I'm just writing it.
Well,
and
you know,
she's taking me where she's going.
By William James, and actually, it was Gertrude Stein. I think he was one of her professors at Harvard, and sort of that whole stream of consciousness, which is what William James coined that term, stream of consciousness, is what... One of the things I think inspired Gertrude Stein.
And his brother was Henry James. A lot of people don't know that.
I know, and Henry James was really at odds with the whole mystical tradition, but they were brought up under Swedenborg, who was that Swedish psychic medium. I did study Henry James as well. He was his younger brother, but William James was really the one who started to open up to all that mysticism, and I think that put him at odds with his brother Henry James, who was quite a rationalist.
Well, they never had a total falling out, but it's interesting to think, if we think of it, they're kind of a hereditary, when we talk about us being ready as a human race, it's because genetically we're ready, right? And it's interesting when you see these genetic ties and you know, we're ready in terms of our DNA is ready. So it's interesting to see this when you look at a family like that. You know, the father was very spiritual, the mother was spiritual, the kids, one went off on a creative direction and one went off on a, you know, with psychology and spirituality. But you see that. See, it's that same force working through us, right?
Well, the father of them both was quite an open, liberated thinker, and I think that's what inspired both those guys to be creative in their own ways, you know?
Yeah, and it's an amazing family. There's a
William James expert in New York, you know, Jonathan Brickland. He's wrote a lot about William James.
I think I've read one of his books, I think.
Yeah.
I've been reading quite a bit about James, and it's kind of getting to be a blur to it.
I think James was also inspired by Emerson, because there's a lot of Emerson. There's a lot of Emerson was a great mystic himself.
Well, one of the things Gopi Krishna told us to do when we were, you know, when we knew him, and we said, well, how can we, because his point was always that the scientific and medical communities needed to understand that this was going on, because so many people would be having these experiences. It wasn't that he cared about science and medicine, but that, so that the people who had experiences weren't going to be treated like they were crazy, right? And one of the things, so we said, what can we do to further this if we can't get real scientific research? He said, study the lives of the great mystics and geniuses. And he said, you will see that even if, no matter what their culture was, if you look at the characteristics of awakening that are described in the yogas, in the yoga sutras, in the yoga texts, the ancient yogic texts, he said, you will find that they all had kundalini awakenings. You know, whether you call it something else.
Even Einstein, even Newton, for sure. I mean,
that's right. So we've been doing this, a group I'm part of called the Institute for Consciousness Research here in Canada. We've been doing these papers, and you can go on our website, and there's papers on Walt Whitman, on Brahms, on Hildegard
of
Bingen.
What's the website? What is the website?
It's ICR Canada.
ICRCanada.org.
And you can go on the website, and you can read these papers, and anybody who wants to, go to my website, which is terrydegler.com, and write me a letter, I'll send one that I've written on Hildegard, and it's called, Yogini in Nun's Clothing, because she's a classic. She's a classic yogini, but she was a Catholic saint, right? So as we see these, just exactly what you're talking about, these relationships, and in the people, and many of these pay Emerson. There's a wonderful paper on Emerson there. There's a wonderful paper on Whitman.
Thoreau, he was quite an amazing.
Yeah, and when you look at it in those terms, you can see, wow, these were enlightened beings, and they maybe weren't, they weren't Ramakrishna and they weren't Christ or Buddha, but they were on this path of evolution.
Well, when you get to the stage of Ramakrishna, I think you just emanate. You don't even need to write what's happening. You're emanating the essence of that, or like maybe Jesus or Buddha. It's like that's another level of it.
But they did share their stories, right?
Yeah.
They were storytellers.
Yes.
They told their stories so that their new knowledge, they brought new knowledge. That was the key. They brought new knowledge to humankind.
And that's what creativity
does. Exactly. Exactly, Alan.
New knowledge, new life, new, it's our evolution. And I think we're coming to a time where all of us will wake up to that potential. These great people you talk about weren't any different from us, but we all have that same potential. But we have to somehow let that unfold.
That's it. And we're in the, and step one is recognizing that we are in this process of unfoldment. Mm-hmm. That we hold this divine evolutionary energy within us. We don't have to look outside. We don't have to find a guru. We hold it within. But what we do need is a framework. What we is helpful is a framework, so that we have a framework of understanding the transformation.
What do you mean by framework? What does that mean exactly?
Well, I mean, it could be anything. It's like me. I had those experiences when I was a kid, and they just blew my mind, and so I ignored them. But later on, when I had other mystical experiences, I could say, oh, that was a Kundalini experience. That's no big deal. I'm not crazy. I have a way of thinking about it. Or
right,
maybe
right. That's why I think more people have to talk about it, so it's not only plant seeds, but other people can relate to what's happening as well.
Yes, so that's what I mean by called a map, a way to put things in context that you have. You could put it in a Christian context or a Kabbalistic context, but it's helpful to have a context to say, wow, my whole worldview just got shattered, but I'm not nuts, right?
Right. I do think we have to transcend the old religious dogmas and just create a science and, in a way, a religion of being humanism, which is nothing to do with the dogmas of the institutions that have grown up around the great teaching. So anyway, that's another discussion. Terry, I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Oh, I did too, and your questions and your comments were enlightening, and thank you very, very much.
Right. So your website again is?
Just terrydegler.com, TerriDegler.com. And, one cool thing, if you know anybody who lives in Germany or speaks German, The Divine Feminine Fire has just been published in Germany by Aquamarine Verlag, and it's called Shakti und Sophia. So just Shakti and Sophia in German, and I'm hoping we're spreading the word.
Well, we'll talk again. Are you coming back to New York at all?
Sure, sometime.
All right, let me know. Send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Alan. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Be in touch, and I'll let you know when this is posted, okay?
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. I've been talking to Terry Digler and about her book, The Divine Feminine Fire, Creativity and Your Yearning to Express Yourself. That was an interesting conversation, really inspiring conversation, because it's all the things that I believe we are coming into as our own active creative evolution that is transforming society and everything around us, and it all seems to be a good thing. So thank you for listening tonight. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and my website is newrealities.com, and you can also email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. Okay.